Welcome, everyone, to the Off Track Podcast. It is great to have you here. Thank you for pulling a chair up to the table. I am your host, as always, Matt Eshe. This week, we have the incredible privilege of sitting down with Walt Drenth, the former director of cross country and track and field at Michigan State University. Sit back as Walt discusses the simple reasons behind his success, not only at Michigan State, but at Arizona State and his coaching career, his love for sport and competition, and the one thing the coaches should never forget. Let's go ahead and get this one rocking and rolling. Ladies and gentlemen, Walt Drenth. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Off Track Podcast. This is going to be a lot of fun tonight. We've got the privilege of having Mr. Walt Drenth on here. We're going to introduce him here in a second. But first and foremost, let's get to our panel. A little smaller panel than we're used to tonight. First off, down over in the Rio Grande Valley, he is getting things rocking and rolling. He's got his duty of gymnastics going on tonight as a normal Wednesday night for him. But Mr. Darren Flowers, Darren, how you doing, buddy?
And the slate is full today. I have been going and going and going and going. But I'm glad to be here. Glad to have this conversation. I think it's going to be a good one.
Man, I'm excited for it as well. No questions about that. We got the gentleman who believes the retired lifestyle might be the way to go from now on. Actually, I think what we'll do is we'll get him an armchair and he can just kind of ride out to practice and give himself a stool. But Mr. John Bell, how we doing, buddy?
We're doing well. Yeah, it's the retired lifestyle the last couple months with the COVID shutdown and then an extended Christmas break. It's been kind of nice. Although I will say we got kids are all back doing some COVID testing. We got 3 inches of snow today. So even if we get through COVID testing, I don't know how we're going to have track practice in the snow. So we'll figure it out, but happy to be here.
I think if anything, if you want to do it, you could probably give Gary Wilson a call and let him and recruit him to come down.
Every time Gary's great at shoveling tracks. I see what he puts on Facebook. I'll give Gary a call. He can come down and shovel our track.
You might have a snowblower for him. You never know. Yeah. And then, of course, out west, attempting to live the good life. We didn't ask him last week, but we'll ask him this week. Is all the shit off your high jump pit?
You know, we finally were able to. The funny thing is it's wintertime here, so all of the water is shut down out to that area. So we couldn't like actually get the pressure washer out there to clean it off. We finally got a truck to come out there, basically like a little fire truck that came out there and hosed it down, got all the geese shit off. And then now this week we have a bunch of snow on it. So, and the next 2 days are full of snow. We're supposed to get like 10 to 12 inches here, and they're supposed to get like 6 to 10 feet up in the mountains. So, you know, we're going to do the best we can and, you know, try to figure out how to get some training in. So, but excited to be here tonight, excited for this conversation.
And I tell you what, I miss the Midwest. I was telling Walt earlier before we got on this podcast here, got going a little bit, I do miss the snow and all that stuff. I think my parents have about 13 inches on the ground. But at the same time, I'm glad I don't have to train in it. I mean, it's 60 degrees outside right now in Birmingham. We don't have to worry about much. It's going to be a nice cool day tomorrow when we travel. Like, I don't have to worry about that stuff. It's kind of nice walking outside in January in shorts and a t-shirt.
Just tornadoes. That's all you got to worry about.
Oof. That one missed the house by about 3-4 miles. That was scary. So was not digging that one at all. But
that's scary.
Yeah, it is. So as we mentioned earlier, we have an incredible gentleman joining us tonight. Very, very fortunate to have this conversation to learn from him. We have I've said this before, the newly retired is just a weird thing to say for me, Coach. We have Coach Walt Drenth on with us tonight. Coach, how you doing?
I'm doing well, man. Thanks for having me, guys.
No, absolutely. It's a blast to have you. I got to ask a question, of course, because I tend to make fun of everybody just a little bit, but you got two deer in the background and two beautiful deer. And of course, those aren't yours. Am I correct on that?
That's correct. They're my uncle's. And if you could see peripherally, you'd see the bear stuck on the wall too.
I don't want to scare too many people with the bear, but that it's beautiful. So, Coach, you're sitting back, relaxing. Where are you right now?
I'm in Cedarville, Michigan. It's up in the eastern part of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I'm visiting my aunt and uncle. He's a retired superintendent and has a wood shop, and I like to do. I'm learning to do some woodworking, and yeah, just came out to hang out with him for a few days. Really fun.
That'd be fun. Get up in the Upers. Are you a pasties guy? You enjoy those?
Yeah, I do actually. Hard not to.
It's hard not to. Absolutely.
What could go wrong with a meat pie? I don't know. I can't come up with a problem with that.
There's a good point. That's one of my favorite things growing up, with a pasty. No questions about that one. That's awesome. I mean, doing some woodwork can at least put some time, gives you some time to sit and be do a lot of attention to detail, which you did a lot in your career. But one thing I've never known, I've never asked you this, as much as you and I have seen each other out and about, we've seen each other meet some recruiting. I know you're at Arizona State to start, but if you would, give us a little background, because honestly, I think most everybody know you as green and white Michigan State.
Well, actually, it started in the mid-'80s at Central Michigan.
Okay.
I coached there for 5 years. We it was really, you know, it was a great time in my life. It was good teams. We were really fortunate to have some exceptional kids on the team. My first All-Americans there, we made two nationals in cross country and had, you know, some good track and field teams. From Central, it was kind of a weird final year. My parents were close. I was close to my parents, and they were big part of our lives and in the kids' lives. In fact, we on Labor Day we went with the team up to Charlevoix, right? It's in northern Michigan, the Lower Peninsula, for a few days of train and just kind of hang out. And they came down for a meet 2 weeks later and drove home. And on the way home on Sunday night after church, were killed by a drunk driver. It was super devastating, and it was a pretty tough. You know, sort of the end of the time there, I was newly married, and we just felt like we needed a change of pace. And fortunately, it had gone well for us at Central, and Dan Stimson at William & Mary called, and I ended up at William & Mary for 6 years before going to Arizona State. Greg Kraft called, and he'd been at South Carolina while I was at William & Mary, and we'd had some pretty good luck. We had some really good guys there. Paul Vandegrift was NCAA runner-up. Brian Hyde was collegiate 1500 meter collegiate record holder with co-collegiate now I'm going to totally draw a blank, Arkansas. I'll remember in a minute, but
it's okay.
So we had some really good kids. They weren't the only ones. And Greg was at South Carolina at the time, and he kind of recruited and talked me into going out to the desert. It was a big change of pace, but we had a couple of really small children and thought, well, let's give it a shot. It was a good move for us. And then really fortunate to come back to in 2004, to be able to come back to Michigan State to coach where you guys all know, it's really rare to coach where you grew close to where you grew up. That's just pretty, pretty rare. And so it felt like, you know, quite an opportunity to get back and reconnect with our family. Christmas time. I mean, you guys know if you're going for Christmas, it's not quite the same. So being able to go, come back and interact with grandparents and uncles and aunts. And that was pretty cool. My kids both graduated from Michigan State.
Okay.
So it was we've been here since 2004, and Daryl Gatson was the head coach then. In 2006, I became the director of the program. They combined the programs and I've been here for quite a while, and then retired this at the end of November after cross country season, essentially.
Jeez. I mean, yeah, it's nice. You haven't had that many stops, but at the same time, you've been very blessed to be able to come back to Michigan State, to come back to the home state and work.
Really.
Yeah. For somebody else.
Who's some really cool places too. I mean, Williamsburg, Virginia, and Tempe, Arizona. I mean, there's some cool stops.
Now, you've got a lot going on. I've never been to William Mary before. I've been out to Tempe once, and it's gorgeous out there. No questions about it. Beautiful. You got great training. It's a little hot every once in a while, but you probably figured that one out. What did you do? What happened? Because you did, if you read through it, you look through it, you had an incredible turnaround at Arizona State and an incredible turnaround at Michigan State. Because I remember when I was at Iowa and you'd go up against Michigan State, no disrespect to, Sparty, but, the first couple of years when we were there, it wasn't that big of a, we really weren't worried. And all of a sudden, and I apologize for that completely, but you weren't. No, it was one of the schools. We were there. And so how did you turn around like Arizona State and Michigan State?
You know, I'm going to say good help and luck. You recruit kids and you kind of give them a vision and you keep just repeating, this is what our expectations are. The Arizona State was an interesting one because they were terrible. My first year, we were, I think we had six of the last seven spots at the conference, at the Pac-10 at the time, at the cross country championship. And that was, oh, that was really hard. And I had, and there were two kids that had just graduated from William & Mary that were there at the meet.
Oh,
and, I got my head, my hands. I'm like, what have I done? The funny thing is the only reason why we had six of the last seven is the kid from Arizona broke his foot and he had to walk in. And one of the kids, he had a blister on his foot. He goes, "Hey coach, you think I should stop? I have a blister." And I said, "You know, it might be a good idea to try to finish this one." And he did. He did.
The other guy's got a broken foot. I mean, come on, you can finish with a blister.
Yeah. We just recruited and created a vision, and we're fortunate to convince some kids to come run, and the kids have to buy into the culture, and once they created a culture that was high expectations, it was, and then you can off you go.
Do you remember what that vision was? I'm just kind of curious because you talk a lot about it, and I figured I'd transfer right over to Sparty.
Sure. I mean, being a national level team, I think it's, you know, in the Pac-10 and the Big Ten, it starts with, if you're credible in the conference, you're going to be credible at the national level. Mm-hmm. So you have to start thinking about it in that, you know, start with where you can, you know, make some steps forward. So we wanted to be competitive and credible in the conference, and knowing in both of those conferences, if you start to make inroads, you're going to be a national level team. But we recruited kids that, you know, we want you to come here to be good. If you don't want to be good, this is probably a bad fit. And do our best to just try to get them to recognize what that meant. Because, you know, everybody, you know, the kids got, they probably got tired of me saying this, but everybody can live an Army commercial, be all you can be, you know. But it's like, okay, so you got these goals. What does it really mean? I mean, you got to identify the things that are necessary to be good and embrace them. Otherwise, we're wasting our time.
Yeah, no doubt about that. What was, just curious here is, we'll get into another question here in a second, but what was one of the red flags? What has always been a red flag for you when you were you recruiting a kid?
You know, you like to think you have the answers to that. I don't know. For me, it was if they were, I think good people are, there's an element of being selfish that has to exist to be really good. But when they're super self-absorbed, it's usually, they're a bad fit for me. Now, some of them may go other places and be really good. Yep. But, you know, it's a funny question I would ask when I would ask the kids what they gave people for Christmas. And the ones are like, "What do you mean?" Like, well, that was like, right away, I'm like, okay, I got to ask a few more questions, because if you're not thinking about doing something for somebody else, it might not work out for us.
I've never heard that one before, but yeah, I guess you can ask some of those questions of adjectives and say, "Hey, what are three adjectives about yourself?" You know, yeah. And see how a kid responds to it. I got somebody laughed at me one time when I did that, and I was like, but it's actually quickly telling if that kid's going to work out for you. If he's like, "Yeah, this is kind of what I believe," or, "Oh, he has to hem and haw for a long time." They start to hem and haw for a long time.
Right.
You have to understand what the word adjective is, but then you got to go from there. And so that's a great question, honestly.
I think it's not, you know, from my standpoint, and you probably got a better matrix for it, but I've read a couple of books that sort of lead me to believe that I just got lucky a lot, because I don't know if you read Thinking Fast and Slow,
mm-hmm.
by Michael Lewis. Was yep. really interesting. That was by Dan Kahneman, The Undoing Project by Michael Lewis.
Oh, it's one of my favorite books. Right behind me.
And then the most recent Malcolm Gladwell book.
Talking to Strangers.
When they, you know, you remember the part where they talked about how the judges thought if they looked at somebody in the eye, they could figure out them as characters. You're better off asking the computer to make that decision, probably.
Yeah, because that was with the divorce lawyers, if I'm not mistaken, that kind of stuff. Yeah. That stuff's, no, you're right. That's 100% incredible. And you have to have the right fit, because there's a part in there they're talking about we won't go into much in the book, but a police officer from Kansas City that had gone down to Prairie View, Texas.
Oh, right.
And, yep.
Oh,
And that was a disaster.
And the woman from Chicago, what a terrible, yeah, that was.
Yeah,
it's a, hopefully we're going to learn something from those stories.
I hope we do. Absolutely. What actually inspired you to get into coaching?
That's a really good question. I guess, I mean, I think I originally thought I was going to coach basketball and teach and recognize sort of right kind of early on that, A, I love track and field. To me, track and field and cross country are arguably the best sports. And, you know, I know people are rolling their eyes if they're not associated with a sport, but where else can anybody in the world of any size, shape, or color identify with someone in the sport of track and field? And then secondly, it's purely objective. Uh-huh. So it doesn't matter what you think of each other or anything. Like if the shot lands further than someone else, you're the best shot putter. Right. And so for me, I appreciated that. And I saw the politics involved in the other sports and thought that it was a bad fit for me. So that was part of it. I was always super competitive. I grew up with three brothers and I'm sure we drove my parents and everyone around us crazy because we competed for everything. And so it was just like, it just sort of gravitated there. I loved the sport and got some breaks at Coach Parks at Eastern Michigan. I was at graduate school there for a brief period and he got me involved. I had good mentors. I think, you know, it's just, you can credit can go to, or you can say credit or blame can go to a lot of people, I suppose, how I got into the sport, but that's sort of, and then I got a graduate assistantship from Craig Fuller.
Okay.
He offered me a GA's position at Central Michigan. He was the interim head coach at Central and then didn't get retained. And I thought, well, I'm going to go to graduate school, but I may not be coaching or helping with the track team. And they hired Jim Knapp. Jim was a longtime coach there and very, very successful. Won a bunch of Mid-American championships. And we were there together for a couple of weeks. And he said, you know, the distance runners are yours. He's everything I was trying to tell him and teach. And he's like, they're yours. And so I, you know, it's a break. I mean, you can say whatever you want, but most people don't get that. It sort of fell into a lucky spot.
Mm-hmm. But, you might be one of the first people.
Go ahead.
No, I think you did, but I don't think you're one of the first people I've heard to actually blame to get into
coaching. Man, I just walked.
Yeah.
Say that again. I'm sorry. I missed you.
No, I think you're one of the first coaches to come out and say, actually, I may have gotten, might have to blame some people for getting me into coaching. Yeah. I'm going to tell that to Wazork next time I see him. I'm going to blame you for this one. Yeah. But you mentioned something, coach basketball.
Yeah. I like basketball. I played basketball in high school. I wasn't a regular, but I played and I like the intricacies and I like the sport. I still have a basket in my, you know, I still go out and shoot baskets in my driveway. So
I know you bike in the wintertime. Do you go out and shoot buckets when it's 10 degrees as well?
If the driveway's clear.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a Midwest guy for you right there. If the driveway's clear, we're going out and playing, we're going doing something. Biking doesn't matter what we're doing. No questions about that one. So coach, you've been in this for a very long time, but you've done an incredible job with it. No questions there. What are some of the biggest challenges that you've faced in coaching? And maybe even if we want to specify this a little bit more, as kids have developed, because again, you started up, as you said, back in the '80s, you worked your way through a little bit. What are some of the biggest challenges, or is it still like, hey, I just got here and the kids were just the same, like same style of kid, just had to adjust?
I think that's a hard question to answer. I think there have always been challenges. I think that the evolution of some of the challenges I could see even back in the 80s where you could start to see things, some things that became priorities. You just didn't think, well, I'll give you a good example.
Yeah,
like please. What people think they need, the difference between what people think they need and what they want sometimes really gets confused. And you know, like having a conversation with a kid about I can't make my car payment and I need a car, and knowing, I'm like, I know thousands of people that went to college that didn't have a car. You don't need a car for college. And they're like, you don't understand. I'm like, no, actually I do understand. Like, so I think that there's, you know, I think that I think information, while it's really valuable, I think sometimes confuses kids because, you know, there, I worked with Ty Saban for a while, just a brief period of time. I don't know if any of you know Ty, but Ty was is he worked at the Olympic Training Center, and he's kind of, you know, anyway, and he would always say there's more than one way to Rome. And I think that sometimes, you know, the kids get on the internet or they find out what somebody else is doing. And if it's not going great, they think that there's only one way to Rome and it's not where what they're doing. I think that sometimes that information can be dangerous, and I don't know about dangerous, it's just confusing. And it just doesn't help the kids, because there's got, you know, I think a kid has to come to school and buy into what you're doing. They have to kind of, it's almost like the trust test where you close your eyes and cross your arms and fall back into some, and that may be an overstatement to a degree, but if they go home and second guess what they've just done or what they're doing or what the plan is, I think that's a tough hurdle to get over. But I think that, so that's where having good culture is really important, because then you have upperclassmen and kids around you that are say, you know, like sort of the voice of reason there, because at some point they, you know, I start to sound like, I'm going to sound old right now, but like Charlie Brown's teacher, if you've been, you know, if you watch those Charlie Brown specials, where like, wah, 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 like, you know, like after a while you sound like that. And if there's somebody else there going, no, you know what, this is, he's got it right. And it, you know, like, I think I thought we did a pretty good job of setting expectations the first day. Like, we would go to camp, or we would, you know, get together sort of in a kind of a more confined environment and just start setting expectations. If you want to be successful, you know, it's not super complicated, but these are the things you have to do, and then try to get the upperclassmen to reinforce it. And so you get freshmen, for the most part, coming in going, okay, I see what they're saying. And, oh, that person's really good. So, well, if that's what they're saying, then, you know, I got to kind of follow the lead. I'm sure everybody here has found that to be the case. So.
Yeah, we've set the tone, and you have to set the tone right away, no matter. And sometimes, unfortunately, you have to set the tone and then reset the tone, depending on the kind of kids you have or what comes in. And I'm not going to lie, I had to do that here a little bit. I set the tone for what we wanted. It was good. Then had to set the tone again, because we had a whole new, very old class. We had a very young class coming in. And all of a sudden, a couple of years later, I found myself having to dismiss some kids and then reset the tone a third time. And that kind of set us back, but it's not the easiest thing to be able to have to do.
You know, Greg Kraft at Arizona State would be like, you know, sometimes there's just bad fits. And, you know, and he was really good at sort of not having it be personal. Like, like, look, you can try it your way somewhere else, but you can't try it your way here. And I really believe that. I think, you know, recognizing that you've got to come in and say, okay, tell me what to do. And then I'm sure that, you know, these guys do this, probably every coach does the same thing. At some point you start to turn to those kids and ask them questions, that relationship. And I tell a freshman, don't come into my office and tell me what you think, because the conversation's over. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that with any disrespect, I'm not going to be angry, but you've already made up your mind. And if you come in and you genuinely ask me, now we can get somewhere. And then I say, and it won't be long then, when I know you trust me, then I'm going to turn it around and start asking you questions. So,
but that's when you can start asking those questions back, and those things go back and forth, then you know, it's like, all right, let's just go ahead and put the mast up, because the wind's blowing out and we're going to go rock and roll from there.
Exactly.
That's a great feeling. The Scott, you kept looking a little bit like that. You got a question?
No, I was just typing in, because that whole little, you can do what you want, you just can't do it here. That just kind of stuck with me. I was just typing it down so I didn't forget, because it, that's really a great, way when you're trying to build a culture and stuff. And, you know, everybody, they, you know, you have kids that come in and they've had success, and it's like, you know, they want to do, you know, things that they've always done. It's like, well, why'd you leave where you were? You know, if you don't want to try anything new, you should have found something that, you know, was exactly, what you're used to and stuff. So I was just typing that in, and something I think I'm going to, you know, maybe mention to some kids.
So I'll apologize to them in advance.
I will tell them that Mr. Waldrinth, they can go speak to him.
Right.
If they come on up to the wood shop, I'll talk to you a little bit more about everything else. You know,
the hardest part in that situation is to not take it personally, like not make it personal either. because the reality is, you know, we can get angry, and I can't say that I didn't. I certainly did, but it didn't help, right? You just have to say, like, look, this is the path, and just stay on it. You know, like, this is what we're doing, and just stay consistent.
And I think we're living in an age where, you know, everything's on social media and everybody's posting, you know, hey, we did this workout and now we're doing this and stuff. So, like, I feel like, you know, it's constantly, you know, in their face about where, you know, maybe this isn't the path that I should be going, or, you know, and, you know, kind of like you said, there's many ways to roam, but, you know, this is the way that we do it.
Right.
You know, definitely an interesting time for a lot of kids.
Well, you know, and just to double up on that, these kids at the high school level, they become friends, you know, because of social media, and they get to know each other all over the country. And, you know, they see their friends go off to different schools, and, you know, some of them get new shoes and new gear, and then they go back to the coaches off, well, why aren't we getting this, or why aren't we getting that? And, you know, there's always this, you know, comparing and contrasting that, you know, I think back to when I was in college, which, you know, 20 plus years ago, we just didn't have that, right? You didn't compare, because you didn't know any different.
But you didn't know any different, but there's so much stuff. I think the stuff has ruined them too. Like,
well, and I was actually going to ask
full stuff.
And Walt, I was going to actually ask that question, you know, and you're just kind of stick to your time at Michigan State, because I think that's, you know, just from a chronologically, you know, there's been this such a big shift in Division I athletics with all the TV contracts and the money that is poured into Division I, you know, through football and men's basketball. You know, as you kind of maybe started at Michigan State and obviously up to your retirement, what do you see as the biggest shift? I mean, the money is the obvious answer, but, you know, just how do you feel that's influenced kids and the way departments are run and the way coaches coach? I mean, do you feel like there's been a massive change within the last 20 years?
I think athletic departments in general, the people at the top live in fear. I think that they're fundamentally spending a lot of time worrying about the next bad thing that's going to happen. Who's going to say what, or how are we going to respond to this? Or, you know, rather than, and consequently, we're not teaching people like we need to teach people. And that's short. Like, I don't think you get better. I believe to my soul, you don't get better if you're in your comfort zone. And if we can't, if they're afraid for us to take them out of their comfort zone, and I'm not talking about cursing kids out but really challenging them, challenging their thoughts and their, I think that you really run, I think it's dangerous. And great sort of metaphorical story. My wife, when we lived in Arizona, we had a person that would help us do some landscaping. And we had a tree, a Palo Verde tree. And when they put the Palo Verde, it was young, it was a new house. And they put the tree and they put stakes in the ground and they tie wires to it, except for the wires are loose. Okay. Right. And my wife asked the guy, why are the wires loose? And he's like, Mrs. Drenth, he said, if there's no resistance, they can't grow roots. And if we tighten the wires and there's no resistance, they'll never develop the root system that they need to withstand the wind and the stress they're going to be under. And if we leave them loose, then they continue to develop. And it's sort of like, you know, you're challenging a tree. It's like challenging the kids. If we can't challenge them, and I think administrators are afraid of us doing that to a large degree, or even having a conversation about politics or anything that would be a different point of view, we can't. I think it's dangerous, but I don't think the kids grow the same. So I don't know. Maybe that's a long sort of convoluted thing to say, but that's sort of it's something that's always stuck with me. It's like, how do you grow without resistance?
Well, and I think it's interesting because we're also, you know, and we had this conversation, you know, at this point months ago now with Gary Wilson. You know, our priorities have changed. You know, intercollegiate athletics was supposed to be a co-curricular activity, an educational experience.
No question.
And we're supposed to be, you know, educators. We're not in the classroom, so to speak. Our classroom is different. But if we're not educating, what are we doing? You know, I think at the end of the day, that's our job, is to educate. Well,
in getting back to the question, you know, like the Power Five and the money, you know, my wife was, you know, smart and thoughtful and not, I mean, she's a Michigan State grad, but she's not really connected to the athletic world. She's, you know, when the name, likeness and image thing came up, and then this COVID stuff where we were trying to play football with, you know, with endangering people, or whether you believe that or not, she's like, we got to stop pretending that this isn't professional athletics. So we got to pay the kids and stop acting like it's something it isn't. And she said, we know the consequence of that. I mean, it's going to end up that, I mean, there are going to be more sports cut. They're going to be, because there is not an infinite amount of money. And that makes me a little bit afraid, but it's also a complete hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. If we're making these kids, you know, or, you know, challenging them to be, to travel or do whatever they want against their, now you can't say against their will, because supposedly they all want to do it, but I'm not sure that's true. I think, and it's all about the money. I mean, we're playing football this fall because of the money. Every athletic department in the country that makes money in football had to play football in order to keep going. So she's like, let's just pay them. I've talked to other people about this. You know, there are models out there now, and I think the Knight Commission made this recommendation to separate football and have it be its own entity. And maybe that's the answer. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I wish Mike Erb would have been on tonight. Because, you know, he said this a few times, you know, the jumps coach at Indiana. He said, you know, Division I has this problem, this reconciliation problem, where you have, on one hand, you've got the basketballs and the footballs that are clearly moneymakers. And we're talking in context of name, image, and likeness. And yet you have all the other, the Olympic sports, right, that are amateur. And so, you know, the NCAA wants to keep those sports as amateurs, and then, well, you can't pay the football and the basketball players because they're supposed to be amateurs, but yet we're going to play them as if they're you know, they're going to play like professional athletes.
Right.
And so how do you balance those two things? You know, on one hand, you need your football players and your basketball players to make your money, but yet everybody else, you got to keep amateur status. It is definitely it's been a point that we've talked a lot about, probably ad nauseum on this podcast, but part of the reason we do it, but it's an important issue. It's really an important issue. And it's fascinating to me, again, because I always come to it from a political standpoint, and it's very fascinating with Senator Booker and I think Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut have this, they've written a bill in the United States Senate to, you know, this athlete's bill of rights. I think the NCAA might be a little worried right now with this new administration that's just taken office, and what that leads to. I, in my own kind of personal thoughts, I can kind of see the NCAA shaking a little bit and thinking they might be the AAU of the 1970s and losing, potentially losing a lot of their power, you know, over what they do.
Well, did you guys hear? I don't know, over the last week, our compliance had said that they had sent back what the NCAA had sent to them for their proposal for name, image, and likeness, and they didn't like it. They said this needs to be more open.
Oh, the Congress, or that's what I said. The current administration is not going to. I think it's too, you know, not going to go real deep politically on it, but it's definitely on the left side of the spectrum. I don't think they want these athletes and these students to profit off of their name, image, and likeness, and they're not going to. I personally don't have a problem with that. I think
there's issues with it. I wonder, Walt, what your take is on this, like where you see this thing heading in the next 5 to 10 years with NCAA. I mean, does it completely change the landscape of what we do?
I think it will. I've said this to a number of other coaches. We need to come up with another model, whether it's collegiate model or club model. That's going to, I mean, what's going to happen to track and field? It'd be interesting to know out within the developmental events in track and field, how many of those kids And I feel like throwing in distance running are probably a little bit more developmental than sprinting and jumping. And I don't like, I'm not saying that you can't get a 24 footer or 26 footer, but the Olympians are typically really good long jumpers in high school, or they've done something pretty special. And but it'd be interesting to know what those developmental kids, how many of those kids are, you know, turn into Olympians. And what's going to happen with our, you know, the depth of our sport? Because I just don't, so I don't so see how COVID sped it up, but I don't think that COVID is the problem. We keep saying that. We'll go back. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but go back to the beginning of my recollection is knowing some really good high level coaches that were making, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $150,000 to $200,000, maybe low $200,000 a year. And they were making the same amount of money as the offensive and defensive coordinators. And this was in the early 2000s. And you know, at the Power Fives now, all the offensive and defensive coordinators make million. They make $1 million or high, close to $1 million, if not more. And track coaches' salaries haven't, I mean, we can all attest to that. They haven't gone up like that. They pretty much stayed flat, and that's what, right, Scott? And that's sort of been the evolution of the other sports, those two sports specifically. But they're not making money at the same at a higher rate, and everything costs more. I mean, every time we get on an airplane, every time we go to a hotel, it costs more. But there's not, but the football and basketball team needs more to keep going. Anyway.
No, it's okay. You can keep going on the soap opera. We're all in the same boat, and we've all been on that soap opera too, that soapbox, whatever you want to call it. I was just talking to somebody a couple of days ago, and he said, "Oh yeah, here's other friend." And he's like, "Sorry, football team here at UAB, but at the same time, they're like, oh, they thought they needed 190 guys on the roster." I was like, "190 guys? Are you effing kidding me? Like, seriously, 190 is like, oh, we just needed 130. We had 131. We needed to cut one." I'm like, "You just have 130 guys on your football roster. I can still go with a full track team, go four deep, and I'm still going to struggle to keep up with a football roster just to keep up with the Title IX numbers, if you even want to go down that route." And imagine how much stuff you have to buy for that, plus the GAs, plus the assistants, plus all that stuff.
I had to talk with someone about this yesterday. Like, if you think about track and field and starting positions and what most men's rosters are, and then take the scholarship out of it, and how disproportionate the whole thing is. Like, every sport should be allowed to at least have enough people on their roster to have fill every starting position, and then have some developmental kids, right? You got to have somebody in the wings if somebody gets hurt or sick, or what's next, especially with 12.6 and 18 scholarships. It's not like they're coming in and just jumping into the role and being as good as the kid that left. It takes them a couple of years to climb the ladder. And, you know, they never even heard that argument. Like, well, that seems ludicrous to me. You can't, I mean, how can you run a men's track and field program if you really want to call it track and field and then have a 35 person roster? It doesn't make it's ridiculous.
No, not if you want to compare it, you know, apples to apples, you know, a track roster versus a football or a basketball or baseball roster. It certainly doesn't make any sense from that perspective. You know, it was really interesting because, you know, we talked about Minnesota months ago with their decision to drop indoor track, and well, at the time, indoor and outdoor track, but obviously you got the outdoor track reinstated. But I saw this on Twitter the other day, and I can't even remember who was tweeting about it, but they were talking about the football roster sizes. And one thing I'd done back when we were talking about Minnesota in the fall is I took a look at their football roster and just kind of using their 2019 statistics. And their football, the size of their roster was, I think, 110 guys or 108 guys or something like that. And of those 100 plus guys, over 50% of the roster saw playing time in three games or more in 2019. That percentage dropped down to 40% in 9 games or more. So if you just do some simple math on that, you're talking about 40 guys out of a 100 guy roster that actually, you know, saw the field, So right. when you start talking about guys, you know, obviously, you know, they have 85 scholarships and you're talking guys 75 through 85. What are they actually bringing to the team? I don't want to take away opportunities for football players, but really, what's the point in having that many guys? You know, NFL coaches can get away with 53 guys and a lot more games.
Squad.
And they do have a small practice squad, but even then, their total numbers capped at 65, I believe, in the NFL between the active roster and the practice squad. But I don't know. I there's so many inequalities in Division I athletics these days. It's, you know, I don't know where you put your finger on because there's so many, you know, anymore. But
my worry is really, like, I think Minnesota dropped track and field, but most of the Power Fives for a while anyway will sustain it. I worry about the Mid-American schools and you watch like Central Michigan, but the mission is always the same for the football, most of the basketball and the ADs, coaches, is to go there, get it going, take a big pay raise and go somewhere else. They're not attached to the school and they're not attached to the community. Not really. They can say they want, somebody could come on here and call me all kinds of names, but it's not true because the first time they get a payday, they're gone. And the consequence of that is then the school has to go find somebody to replace them to chase a rare opportunity like they did at Western Michigan a few years ago where they got $6 million. As if $6 million solves an athletic department problem, right? Like, it's just absurd. All it does is create more problems because now they're hiring a coach at more money than the guy that just left. And where's the money going to come from? Not like people aren't they're not building a bigger stadium. So it's going to have to come from a sport.
You know, it's almost like a bubble, like an economic bubble that's been growing for a while. And I think it's just becoming more exposed than ever. And as I hear you talk, that's makes me think about it that way because of the amount of money that's just in the last 10 to 15 years has been dumped into those sports and facilities and coaching salaries and things like that. So
I think they keep up with them, but then you go like, just go back to the Mid-American. I went to Central Michigan. They have those games on Tuesday and Wednesday night and there's nobody in the stands. They won't even show a camera into the stands. They fix them on the field and on the home and visiting team's bench because they don't want to sit. They don't want them to see that there's nobody there on Tuesday night. It's absurd.
No, unfortunately, you need to take that money and, you know, hey, this is when ESPN is going to put us on. That's the contract we're going to get. We're going to take it and go. And luckily enough, you know, we got some stadium networks and some of that kind of stuff is starting to pop up. But you're right. It's a cool day. And you know what? We're not going to go sit outside for 3 hours to watch a Tuesday night football game. You know, Thursday night. Yeah. But Tuesday, Monday, Wednesday. No, there's no way. Why would we? It stinks for that stuff. If we bring it back a little bit, let's have fun. Let's bring it back. We can, cause we can keep going. And I bet you we're going to somehow end up back in that same boat that we're just in a little bit. No, and it's okay. Honestly, it's good stuff to hear from somebody who's been in this for a long time because we can sit around younger coaches and say, hey, there was this stuff that we've heard before, what's going on. But we keep hearing the same rhetoric from coaches who have been in here or have retired saying, guys, this is coming. Just be careful. And that's one of it's the exact same thing that we're hearing. Okay. So just because I'm going to jump here. I was going to do this later, but I'll ask you now. Is there something right now that you would tell yourself, tell the younger version of yourself, like, hey, I'm getting into coaching. This is something I should keep keep my eyes and ears open for.
I became a better coach as soon as I had children. And if someone would have told me to treat your athletes like you would want someone to treat your child, again, I don't think I was ever abusive, but I think I really switched then to more of a teacher than a pusher. And I think it was at that point that I really solidified my philosophy that it couldn't be mine, it had to be theirs. So then it wasn't I hope that I was never, it was never about me, but I hope I got further away from that idea that was about me and more about them. And understanding that, you know, like reading, you know, like the longer you coach and I've gotten to be a better reader, recognizing that, you know, like everything, you can grow from any position, anything, that any failure in every opportunity is a learning opportunity. I think that if I could slow myself down in younger and say that, I'd probably say that. Yeah. I had some really good mentors and some really good advice. And, you know, people said, you know, told me early on, you know, develop a philosophy of life and then have that be sort of your guiding principle for coaching. And that helps immensely. But I think taking it further and kind of recognizing the learning piece and, you know, the mistakes are part of growth, that, you know, I'm probably a lot more forgiving than I was, you know, 35 years ago.
I've heard that before, that once you have kids, or, you know, once you have kids, that you become a little bit more, as you said, that teacher. And that's a phenomenal word to use, I think, because that's what the one thing we forget to do as coaches is remember, we are supposed to be teachers. I can't remember right. Who said it earlier. John may have said it, but you have to. The excuse me. Something we've talked about a little bit here, and we've talked about off microphone, off taping, whatever you want to say. One of the things we're doing, because we're going to kind of age ourselves a little bit, even though I think a lot of us have a few more years in this, and Herb isn't on here. So I know, what is he, 50, 60, 70 years old? Who knows how old he is? That's what happens. You don't on the podcast, you're going to get made fun of. But you know, you had mentioned that, if I'm not mistaken, I read this correctly. So when you cannot give everything to yourself every day, you would walk away. And are there signs? I mean, each coach is different. Every coach is different. Coach Wazorik at Iowa was different. You're different than him. But were there signs that, like, hey, I just can't give it anymore? Or what are some of the things that you saw?
Yeah, I mean, there was some, like, not to go very deep into the weeds, but there was some couple of personal things that, you know, like some well-being things that I had to pay attention to, and in the distractions of those things certainly had an influence, because I didn't feel like I could give the kids the energy that I needed and really honestly take care of myself the way I needed to. I think we probably all make the same mistakes in this job, and that is, you know, you kind of, you look at the calendar and you go, okay, I can go see the doctor on, these are my 3 days of options, or my week that I have an opportunity to do this stuff. That's how I was anyway. And so I would put everything off. I think I just lost you. No, I didn't. Okay.
Nope. You're good. Yep. You're still good. Okay.
Yeah. I would put things off and then try to do it at Christmas break, or, you know, a couple of weeks in the summer after the Olympic trials or the USA championships or whatever. And it's like, that doesn't mean that the doctor's available. It just means, well, I can go see the dentist today. Let's go see. It doesn't work like that. So I think, you know, like those, yeah, it was some, and so you start thinking about it in the context of that. And then I just thought that, I watched Coach Stankiewicz and Coach Seminole, you know, really having these, and it's not like I didn't have good relationships with the kids. There wasn't anything negative there, but I, like, they've got the energy and they're doing the things that I need to be doing every day. And being a head coach is completely different. It's not it's not like when you're coaching the distance runners or an event group where you just worry about them. You're kind of worried about a lot of things, and you're worried about stuff you never talk to the staff or the kids about. I don't know. It's at some point, for me, it was some of the stuff that I always look forward to the adventure. And if there was a rub someplace, it didn't bother me. It was like, okay, let's see how this is going to go. And then after a while, it's like, oh crap, I got to do this. You know, like it's the adventure turned into like, oh, this isn't really, I'm not excited about this. And I don't think that's fair. I didn't think that was necessarily fair to the kids, but it was, you know, I would have probably, yeah. I mean, if it wasn't for a few just kind of uncomplex but necessary personal stuff, I probably still be doing it. So
yeah, I won't get into the personal stuff with that stuff, because again, that's personal. We'll leave that on.
Yeah,
the,
it's
on
not
the
family related. It was just, you know, just trying to take care of myself.
So we've talked about this before on this podcast, and I know John has, you know, voiced his opinion on it too. And we just talk about like work life balance as a coach. One is there such thing as a, you know, NCAA a track and field cross country coach. And then the other thing would be, you know, should we look at that? Should we examine that as coaches and the profession as a whole?
I think the answer is yes, it should be examined. Is it possible? I think that's it's a serious challenge. I think that, you know, my wife and kids were a priority, but I wonder if I shortchanged them. I'll get, like, this fall, nobody's traveling and we went to Northern Michigan and we kind of took a circuitous route. The colors were really good. And we stopped for at this outdoor dining place for a beer and a slice of pizza. And I go, this is kind of fun. And my wife's, she looked at me and she said, you know, this is what normal people do. I'm like, okay. So I can't say, you'd probably have to ask her if I got the work life balance thing down.
I don't know. Go ahead, John.
No, I was going to say that's this lockdown, you know, is just, I know I joked about it at the beginning of, you know, I'm kind of living this retired life where I'm just, you know, walking the dogs and watching the TV and you know, doing whatever. Like, yeah, that's what normal people, that's what you do. And it's so, it does make you realize what we do in athletics, regardless of the sport. I mean, obviously, you know, we're track and field coaches, cross country coaches, so we're busy year round. It just makes you realize how crazy and hectic, you know, and in some ways, special, you know, what we do, it really is special. And it takes a unique person and personality to really want to do what we do year in and year out. But on the flip side of that, I've picked up hobbies that I didn't know I had or interests that I didn't know I had. And I'm like, damn, is there a way to monetize this so I can do this instead?
Well, you know, I think it does show how much, you know, weight that we put on our shoulders. But I think also it shows, like, for me, I recognized and appreciated my wife and what she takes on when I am in that mode. And man, our significant others, they are superheroes.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it.
You know, thinking about COVID and, you know, the way we, you know, normally do our lives and, you know, the recruiting and the home visits and things like that. I mean, it's like, we don't have to do that. You can Zoom calls, you can do, I mean, if this has kind of taught us anything, hopefully a lot of coaches have kind of learned from this and we don't kind of, you know, go back to the rat race of having to be at, you know, every major championship when we're allowed to go recruiting or, you know, being the first one in the door on, you know, opening day of recruiting and stuff like that. It's like, you know, I think we are, you know, kind of, we've said this before, we're our own worst enemies. You know, if we, you know, all would kind of take a step back and it's like, you know, is being that number one phone call to that recruit, or the first phone call to that recruit going to be the difference maker? You know, it's like, you know, maybe we should be kind of looking and, you know, how do we take a step back and, you know, kind of have more of a, you know, a life work balance.
It you know, and I'm sure you all feel the same way. I'm blessed to have been able to coach. It's a great calling. From my standpoint, I don't think I could come up with anything that would be like, what a great way to make a living. I mean, if you think about it I don't really fundamentally have any complaints. I just make, this is just my observations. And I think you make a really good point. I think it's really hard not, I think one of the things I would, you know, kind of going back to a question you asked earlier, Matt, but sort of to Scott's point about work-life balance is figuring out who fits to your university, who fits in your, in sort of simplifying recruiting, because I think sometimes we make those first calls like they're the end all, but are we identifying the people that are going to work? And are we identifying the people, like there's a kid, most of the kids, they kind of know where they want to go. I believe that. I think five visits is too many. But I also think that, you know, as a coach, we're better off finding the fit instead of trying to find, you know, like recruiting the numbers doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily the best answer. And I think that go back to Scott's point of like simplifying it, it's just like, okay, who fits our profile? You know, with the type of kid that chooses Michigan State or UAB or, you know, Nevada, wherever you're at, what type of kids are those? And look for those kids instead of trying to look for that. If I could just get this one kid, then the thing would just turn in a different direction. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think when we've had our most success, they were kids that believed in the school that I was at. They believed in the place, they believed in the people around them. And that's probably more important than the numbers that they brought.
Actually, thinking about that for a little bit, like, and Scott, go ahead and hear in a second, but like thinking about that, every time we've had a good team or we've had that good groups, we didn't have to worry about it. You had the kids that came in right away, did what they're supposed to do. And if I'm not mistaken, a lot of the kids that we got that worked out the best, we had only three visits. They only had only three schools chasing them. And of course you were one of them. Like we, you know, whoever was one of them. And I always thought, man, why only three schools recruiting this kid? But then they come in and they're a rock star. And then you get a couple of kids that, you know, took five visits. So I'm going to take all five visits.
Right.
To what point are you going to take all five visits? Does it matter? Cause you knew it, from the minute you stepped on campus. Remember my visits, my second visit I took was Iowa. I knew it. I just needed to go to Minnesota and Nebraska afterwards just to solidify it. And I canceled my visit to Wisconsin because I was like, no, I know where I'm going. Why waste more time? Why waste the university's time? And at least be respectful to Coach Schumacher at the time and Coach Nedeljko. I'm like, this isn't going to work. So yeah, you're right. I love the fact, actually, I've never heard somebody say we should reduce the amount of visits before. But if you put that in front of me, if we try to put it at the convention, nobody's even going to vote for it because nobody knows what's going to go on. It's going to be just debated. But I would 100% stand up and vote for it and be like, why not reduce the number of visits and make it a little better work-life balance on us, because when we can move on or we can get our numbers or we can do what we need to do.
It's not as if they're not taking unofficial visits, yep. Right? So it's not, if a kid doesn't sign and they've taken their three visits, they can always come. Yep. And maybe you put a caveat in there where, like, if you came for an unofficial because you'd taken your officials and you signed with us, then you can come in for a fourth or a fifth visit, and that would be a legal option.
Mm-hmm. You know, and we're just kind of talking about recruiting and stuff, but you know, I'm sure, you know, all of us, we're not in the office anymore, but yet, you know, do we really need? I mean, I used to go in the office every morning and then I'd come home at night, and now I'm kind of wondering, what was I really doing in the office all the time? You know, I mean, I can do work from home just, you know, on my laptop. And I mean, you know, I miss running into, you know, some of the other coaches and chit chatting and stuff, but it's like, you know, I mean, I'm able to get as much work done on my laptop.
I think for me, being there and available to the kids was always important. I thought that, and that's the argument for being in the office, is when someone swings by, those interactions are more valuable probably than practice time. And that's, so from my standpoint, it's why I obsessed about being in the office. Kid comes by, somebody's going to, you know, we try to set up appointments and that sort of thing. And as the head coach, then there's always the unknown. You go to work and then you get a couple phone calls from somebody. It's like, oh, we need you to do this. Or we've called to change the time of the meeting or whatever, but you want to try to be, I just wanted to be present for the kids.
Mm-hmm. I always thought one thing I've changed the last couple of years, and I can't remember where I took this from, but what I started doing is I've stopped meeting in the office with the kids, because I know that some kids have a negative connotation of coming in the office. And maybe you didn't do it, you know, maybe, well, you didn't do it, or John did it, or somebody did something, but maybe it was younger. When they were younger, they had you have to go to the office, because you always have to go to the principal's office.
All right.
So some kids don't want to go there. So what I've started doing is, there's a couple, and again, I have done this during COVID. You can yell at me all you want, but we social distance, we're masked up, we do everything we're supposed to do, and we sit by ourselves. But and I did this even before this, but we'll go to a coffee shop. You know, we're not going to go have a meal or anything, but we'll go sit down at a coffee shop and sit and talk through things. And a lot of times, before you know it, that normal 10, 15 minute meeting that they wanted to, that was a half hour, 40 minutes. And we just learned a lot more and we were more relaxed, and getting the kid to be relaxed a little bit helped out a ton. And I think Coach, you probably could even attest to that. The more relaxed you are, the more comfortable you are, the more honesty you're going to get out of that kid. And you know what? A lot of days nowadays, who doesn't like an extra cup of coffee or a good tea or a chai, or
right,
you know, just grab a cookie. I don't know.
Well, and I think you speak to an interesting point too, is that, you know, as authoritative as you must be sometime as a coach, they also need to see you as a human and see you as approachable. And so I think we do that dance constantly, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think
between approachable and disciplinarian. Yeah.
And I think one of the challenges you know that you face as you get older is there is a little bit more of a separation in your age, and then there's a little bit more of a gap in terms of how they feel like they can, the kids feel like they can interact with you. You try to stay as relevant as you can, but they come in with preconceived notions about, well, this guy's 55 and I'm 18. How would he possibly know, which is ludicrous in the big scheme of things, because, it's like they think we're inventing the wheel for the first time. Right. But I think that there's a comfort level with age that sort of grows, and maybe the distance is, some of it's good and some of it's bad. I think there's a lot of good because you kind of, your perspective is you just continue to gain perspective as you get older, but you also sort of lose a little bit of the connection. That's just my observation.
No, 100% agree. Cause if you look at it, and not all of us are as in depth in the music as Mr. Darren is. And so sometimes our perception of music might just be what we loved listening to. And of course, Darren being R.I. Wolf and the incredible artist that he is, and sometimes we're not there. So I listen to the music and I go, what in the hell was that they just played? But you know what?
Matt, I'm still way behind though. I hear what they play at practice. I'm like, oh man, what is this?
You're like, what is this? But I think coming down to the level helps out, if you want to call it coming down to the level, but trying to meet them a little bit halfway at a coffee shop or getting food or doing some other, going for a walk on Campus Green, always helps them out a little bit, because you can at least just be talked. And you can, as you said, coach, you're a little bit seen more human than anything else. So a question I got to ask, because we ask a lot of coaches this, and I want to kind of hear what you say, especially from the track and field standpoint. We've talked about it ad nauseam, as some people have said here before, but the changing of track and track and field meets themselves. We're seeing a lot of different changes right now and a little smaller meets and those things. Is there something you believe that, whether they can agree on it or not is a whole nother story, but collegiate track and field coaches should do to change meets to try and increase, attendance at meets or viewership at meets or anything like that? Or are we just talking like, look, you track nerds, this is the product, just try and keep it afloat?
I think that we have to shorten the meets. I think we have to shorten the days. It kind of goes back to, I don't know, it was Scott, work-life balance, or Darren, I can't remember, in having, John talked about it. I mean, I think everybody's talked about it tonight, but I think we go to meet sometimes. Well, we would go to the Raleigh Relays, and I think that there's a place for those meets, right? But you start on Friday at 8 o'clock in the morning or 9:30 in the morning or whatever time. And if you've got kids in the late races, you can be there well after midnight. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's got to be a place for some of those meets. I hope that doesn't sound disparaging to the Raleigh Relays. I love going there. They were great hosts
great meet.
And I'm friends with those guys. I think a lot of their staff, but I think that I feel like I said this for a long time, like nobody cares when Michigan State, except for the parent and the kid and me, nobody cares if a kid from Michigan State goes to Stanford and runs a fast 5,000. Nobody cares except for three or four people. So you go to Stanford or North Carolina State, I mean, there's got to be some relevance to the competition. Now, maybe there needs to be one or two of those weekends, but Ron Mann had an idea a long time ago. He shared with me, I think he was at Northern Arizona still. He said, you go to a meet like Stanford, and if you're in a 10,000 or a 5,000 or a 1,500, and you're not in the top six or seven in the race, your mark shouldn't count for the nationals. If you're not one of the top collegiates, you shouldn't go to the NCAAs, because now you're not racing. Said that we've taken the premium out of competition, and now it's all about marks and performance. And there's got to be a happy medium there. But I think that there's some validity to that. And like Rudy Chapa, I think, came through Arizona State when I was there, and he was talking about the conference meet. And he was talking like we were going to host that year. And he was like, yeah, when I was in college, it was like 109. And he said, I think I was second And they ran 3:38 for 1500 meters. He goes, then we came back and ran the 5,000 and a bunch of guys ran under 14 minutes. Like, but they were just competing. Like, so like we try to, now we're setting up these, like it's gotta be the perfect weather and the perfect conditions and the perfect pace car. And all they did was want to just kick each other's back, you know, their asses. And that was like, and they were good. Obviously they were really good guys, but you're thinking about like, he's complaining about how, like, you know, I got beaten. They only ran 3:39 or whatever it was. I was like, oh my gosh, well, we kind of like, now we don't think we can go unless, you know, the stars are lined up and the wind's perfect and the pace car doesn't go out too fast. Oh, it was,
well, I think it hurts us. What common viewer wants to watch a bunch of people in 10th, 15th, 18th place, you know, just out there running a time trial? I think I agree. You know, Herb's spoken about it a lot, and it's just like the competition, whether the miler runs 4:10 or 4:01 or 3:57, if it's close, it's entertaining.
Right.
Regardless of the time. And I hate that our system is so built on that for qualifying, opposed to, hey, I'm going to race my way in. I'm going to compete my way in. And if I get there, I've beaten everybody along the way, or I've beaten most along the way. And I think that's where we kind of lose our intrigue with track and field, because it just becomes a looking for a personal best or a performance, like you said.
Well, actually, if you think about it for a second, just a fun thought, it just popped in my head here. Anybody watch NASCAR? Every once in a while, I watch NASCAR. And John, you love bike racing, okay? If you look at NASCAR on qualifying Friday or qualifying Saturday, whatever the case might be, there's still tickets being sold. There's still things going on. There's very little people in the stands. Nobody cares. And so if you really want to look at it that way, not the same people don't care about, you know, the 10,000 at 10 o'clock at Raleigh relays, or, you know, out at Stanford or anything along those lines. But that's all it is the time trial. And then of course you come back the next day and you see, you know, the 500, you see the Coca-Cola 600 and you see that stuff racing. I mean, there's 120,000 people packed in there to see an actual race, not a time trial. So if we need to learn something from track and field or from NASCAR, because we are both going around in ovals and making left turns, we should probably take a look at it and go, okay, if you guys are doing the same type of thing we are with time trials, why not turn around and do, you know, why not mimic that? Because apparently they don't do a damn good job marketing what they have going on.
You know, I think there's a lot to be learned there. Some things to be, you know, to digest. You know, I think, you know, to Walt's point, though, a meet like the Raleigh relays or the Drake relays or the Penn relays or Texas or Mount Sac or what have you, there is a place for that, though. And you do need that. You know, I think back to, you know, our best 10,000 meter guy a couple of years ago ran, I don't know, 29, 24, whatever he ran at Raleigh. And he was probably in like, honestly, it was probably like 15th or 20th place doing that. You know, the gun went off and it got in a straight line and, okay, everybody ran really fast, but he needed that time, you know, obviously for qualifying purposes, but I think there is some value to that as well, because I could take him to a small dual meet and he could run, you know, 3:48 or 3:45 or whatever in a 1500 and in that smaller competitive meet. So it's a balancing act that we have to do to try and figure out what is important and what isn't. And I think at the end of the day, I think it's all important. It's just how it gets packaged. And how it gets presented. And we have to do, I think, in my opinion, to do a job of educating the kind of the spectator, not necessarily on the performance of the event, but what the event really is, right? You know, I think of a good example of this would be like the Kentucky Derby. You know, everybody can tune in that first Saturday of May and say, oh, you know, the Kentucky Derby, it's like the biggest race, right? Well, it's the 10th race of the day. You know, a lot of people don't understand that there's 9 other races before that, you know, on that same track, that there are other things going on. And so, I don't know. I think there's just a time and place for a thing like the Raleigh relays or Drake or Penn. And then there's just as much value in the dual meet, you know, it's just figuring out how the schedule and the season actually works, you know, congruently with all those different types of, because they're all different types of competition. But they all have value.
They do. And I think that there has to be a place. The other problem with track and field now is that because our rosters are being forced to be smaller, is a dual meet if it's not more than a couple of teams, it's really difficult to get performances, because sometimes you're triple jumping against yourself, right? And that's, I mean, there is some problems with that. I mean, so you have to be able to create this environment where there's enough people to have it be meaningful, but few enough that it can be short and entertaining. And that's the like, and then a weekend or two where there are those meets where you go and you know, look, this is going to be long. We're just going to try to run fast or jump far or whatever. The conditions are right. You're going to, you know, what is it, UCSD, and throwing the discus into the, you know, towards the ocean, and it just stays up there forever. I mean, those are things that I think you got to have to be able to, because marks still matter, especially for the elite kids. They still have to be able to go somewhere, because they came to your school to see how good they can be and possibly end up at the Olympic trials or the USA championships and make a national team or whatever. And that's, and we've got to make sure we get those kids at their turns.
Right. And, you know, it's also, and I said this way long ago, is we ultimately, I think, you know, before we start talking about the actual track meet, we actually have to, I think, in my opinion, talk about the structure of kind of the structure of the NCAA and what we consider a track meet, right? You know, I watched this last weekend, the American Track League, which we kind of just glossed over that. We didn't even really get into that this weekend, weekend. Mm-hmm. You know, what defines a track meet, right? You know, this idea, and we saw it kind of this summer with some of these small COVID meets. You know, does it, if you were to take a meet, you know, under the current structure, if you were to have, you know, five or six events, and you were able to get some of the best athletes in the nation in that particular event, you could have a great competition. It would be really short. It'd be able to be packaged, put on TV, streamed, whatever. But because the way the NCAA qualifying structure works with the NCAA rule book, that meet doesn't count. Right. And so that, yet, you know, what I watched this weekend on ESPN, you know, that track league, that was a track meet, right? I mean, I know track well enough to know that that was a track meet, but, you know, if that happened in the NCAA, it wouldn't count as a meet. And so I think structurally, if we could change some of those, which is a much bigger fish to fry, but if we were able to fix some of those things, I think you could see, I think that would be a way, Walt, to kind of marry a short meet, you know, a short, small meet with high level competition as well.
I think you guys have to talk with Jeff Molinsky and find, I mean, because I think he's a really valuable resource.
100%.
And talk about how, you know, like, what are the tolerances? Like, how do we make those changes to keep it relevant? Because I think he cares. And you know, I think there are people out there that care. These conversations have to go, and then you're going to have to push some prominent people off their moorings, because there's going to be a lot, you know, there's going to be a lot of angry folk at the convention if you ever have another one.
I think everybody knows I've done a good job pissing off some people at the convention every once in a while with the proposals I put forward for just for cross country itself. If I know I've pissed off a few, it's okay. We've actually wanted to get Jeff on the podcast, but due to, in fairness to everybody, he's declined to jump on, but we're going to keep asking him and keep trying to get him on there.
Who's that?
Jeff Molinsky.
Oh, Jeff. Oh, yeah.
Yep. We've asked a few times. Like, you sure, Jeff, you don't want to get on here? He's like, no, I want to, but I don't want to upset the rest of the NCAA if I get on here and start going. I was like, yeah, we gotta make sure you have at least a little bit of a job. You know, we want you to keep that.
Want him to lose his job.
No, not at all. Coach, one final question here, if we can. And honestly, we could keep going for a lot longer, but I know it's getting late and I know we're all got some stuff to do and just relax. And there's that work-life balance that we want to get into. So what advice do you give coaches 5-10 years down the road, guys like us, girls, you know, the women that are in coaching as well, you know, hey, we're, you know, you guys were in mid-30s, late 30s, early 40s. Like, what kind of advice, or even somebody who's coming into the coaching world itself, that 25, 26 year old, that's just maybe getting their first gig or a couple of years into the first gig. What do you tell those people?
Value learning. Try to be a lifelong learner. I think, read research or whatever, you know, find mentors. I think finding mentors is really important. And it's a challenge for us. I mean, we get our egos in the way and we have other people get their egos in the way and it gets awkward, but I think it's always helpful to have people you can bounce things off of You know, if you're talking with Wiz, or, you know, like, they're, you know, not everybody has that. That's a pretty, that's a quite a good thing. So I would say those things, I would tell you not to have it be about you, but that's how I look at the world. I think it's more fun when it's theirs and then you have fun. I mean, I think it's gotta be, you've got to look at it like it's fun. I mean, we're making a living in sport. That's a pretty rare thing.
That's, you know, fun. Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. So I think that there's, you know, I mean, I don't know, just cherish it and keep thinking of yourself as a teacher. I'd probably say that too.
I do love that. That's one thing I've always heard from not just Wiz, but some other people as well. Not from you, find yourself as a teacher. You do that and you're going to have a lot of fun and you're still going to keep learning life lessons no matter what you do.
Yeah.
So, Coach, it was awesome to have you on here tonight. I truly appreciate you taking the time from the Uper, from being up there to jump on, to join us, to bring the animals in with us, of course, you know, the deer and the bear. It's kind of always great to have with you. But thanks. Thank you for joining us. It's been an absolute blast. And honestly, I've learned a ton.
An honor. Thank you. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. It was nice to meet some of you and see some of you again. And ask, I'll, you know, if I didn't confuse you completely, I can do it again.
We'd absolutely love it. So right. Thanks again, Coach. I truly appreciate it.
All right, much obliged. Take care.
Take care.
Coming on.
Yeah, man, ladies and gentlemen, that one was a lot of fun. No questions about it. That's a conversation I've been truly excited about having for weeks now, and very, very fortunate that we're able to have that happen. So Coach Jones' passion for his athletes is infectious. The one thing he always kept in the forefront of his mind, though, was always to remember that we may be coaching, but we are truly teaching and molding young minds in every moment of the day, every aspect that we do, every interaction that we work with our kids, we are molding and we are definitely teaching them what to do. As always, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for making us part of your day, part of your week, or whatever time we get the opportunity to join you. Thanks for popping the top and making us one of the top running podcasts in the country. We truly do appreciate your support and patronage. If you enjoyed this episode, as always, word of mouth is the best form of advertising. Please tell somebody about it. Please share us on social media, on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter. Actually, we're not on Facebook yet, but share us in almost every platform you can find. If there's any way you want to, anything you want us to discuss, someone you want to go ahead, shoot us a text and let us know. But until next time, ladies and gentlemen, we will talk to you then. Bye.